The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the August 28th, 2026 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is set in a basketball arena. We have WNBA player Sophie Cunningham, plays for the Indiana Fever. She's standing straight, got a kind of a scowling look on her face, and pointing a finger at a retired NBA player, Enes Kanter Freedom. He's wearing an Atlanta jerseys, dribbling the ball. He's kind of got a smirk on his face, but he's also wearing lipstick and eyeliner. The headline is Trans Trolling: The Culture War Over Race, Politics, and Gender in the WNBA. And we get that on the Controversy of the Week. We will start with the first main story. Relief on the way for the exhausted USS Lincoln. What happened? The USS George Washington was ordered to the Persian Gulf this week to relieve the USS Abraham Lincoln, an aircraft carrier whose crew members were suffering deplorable conditions and a growing mental health crisis after a record deployment of more than 250 straight days at sea. Concerns arose after the military newspaper Stars and Stripes and Navy Times reported exhaustion and psychological trauma among the 5,000 sailors and Marine on board the ship, whose deployment was scheduled to end in May, but has been repeatedly extended because of the Iran war. Family members said their deployed relatives described deprivations including broken toilets, inadequate food, contaminated water, lack of soap and toothpaste, and mail disruptions. Several had attempted to jump overboard. The head of U.S. Central Command, Admiral Brad Cooper, who visited the ship, said that while long sea deployments are uniquely challenging, the Lincoln had the fewest mental health cases among the Navy's 11 active aircraft carriers. Meanwhile, reports emerged this week that another ship, the destroyer USS Benfold, had lost power because of a generator problem last month and drifted in the South China Sea for 4 days. During that time, sailors were left without galley services, toilets, and air conditioning. As congressional Democrats called for an investigation into conditions on the Lincoln, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said the media reports completely misrepresented reality, while President Trump insisted the ship was being beautifully taken care of. Asked if he was concerned about the sailors or if they had been at the sea too long, Trump said, "No, no, no. Not nearly long enough." What the columnist said: "As a Navy veteran who spent years on sea duty, I know why the Lincoln crew hit a breaking point," said Theodore R. Johnson in the Washington Post, "and what made a 19-year-old sailor with a wife and a baby at home leap into the water, where he floated for an hour before rescue. For sailors, the days afloat are long, and an extended deployment is a struggle, even under good conditions. When access to food and showers dwindles, mail is held up, port calls are canceled, time seems to stop, making life in the middle of the ocean turn from hard to intolerable." "Yes, military life is hard," said New York Post in an editorial. "What else is new? The left is painting the Lincoln as a hellhole and blaming it all on Trump and Hegseth's supposedly mismanaged war. But the ship's conditions are hardly rare for the military, especially in wartime. In this case, early in the war, Iran bombed the Navy base in Bahrain that was the main supply hub for the Lincoln, forcing a scramble to find new supply routes and ports." "Yet it's not just the Lincoln," said David Winky in CNN.com. "The Navy has begun routinely pushing carriers past the recommended deployment of 7 months. That places more stress, not just on the crews, but on the ships as well. Part of the problem is that aircraft carriers are a finite asset, and at any given time, some are being repaired or refueled." Trump's meddling is about to worsen the problem, said Bryn Tannehill in the New Republic. This month, he ordered the Navy to replace the aircraft catapults on upcoming Ford-class aircraft carriers, insisting that outdated steam catapults will launch the planes better than the new superior electromagnetic systems we now use. The shift will require a massive redesign that will cost billions and delay by years the launch of the USS Doris Miller, scheduled for 2034. To indulge his sense of aesthetics, Trump also wants the Navy to move control towers from the rear to midship on new vessels. With such senseless dictates, Trump has fallen into the folly of dictators, micromanaging procurement and damaging military readiness in the process. The fault here belongs to Hegseth, said William Crystal in the Bulwark. Some 200 family members told Navy officials about horrific conditions on the Lincoln at an August 6 meeting in San Diego, the ship's home port. Hegseth did nothing, and when the story blew up, he and Trump flatly denied there was a problem. And as they blunder through a misbegotten and mismanaged war, they're using up sailors as carelessly and recklessly as they are using up their munitions. We have weeks to go before the Washington arrives in the Gulf. The troops deserve better. And the controversy of the week. WNBA, can the league survive the culture wars? Sports are supposed to be a diversion, said Candace Buckner in The Athletic. But the Women's National Basketball Association suddenly feels less like a sport and more like a societal power keg. When the Indiana Fever in 2024 drafted Caitlin Clark, the leading scorer in NCAA history, male or female, the league's audience exploded, but so did the culture war nastiness. Clips of the straight white Clark being clobbered by black opponents in a league where 25 to 35% of players are publicly LGBTQ+, became a staple of right-wing social media. Then, this summer, Clark's teammate, Sophie Cunningham, became her on-court bodyguard and a social media phenomenon in her own right. Cunningham recently told ESPN that society should protect young girls from playing sports or sharing lockers with biological men, and the already toxic cesspool of WNBA discourse became instantly more poisonous. Pro and anti-trans activists held dueling rallies outside Fever games. But now two burly ex-NBA players, Enes Kanter Freedom, 6'10" and 250 pounds, and Royce White, 6'8" and 270 pounds, have mockingly threatened that if the league doesn't ban male-born players, they'll declare themselves women and enter next year's WNBA draft. With attendance and TV viewership at record highs, this should have been a history-making season for the WNBA, said Rachel Bachman in the Wall Street Journal. Instead, the season has spiraled into absolute chaos amid racial resentment, feuds, and on-court physical fights. Kantner and White are attention-starved trolls who can safely be ignored, said Mike Wise in MS.Now. The WNBA has never had a male-born player, and with about 3 out of 4 Americans agreeing with Cunningham, probably never will. Cunningham isn't a troll, said Case Wickman in Vanity Fair, but the blonde, beautiful social media star likes to seek attention, as she demonstrated with her viral pointing meme after a scuffle with a black player in June, which gained her throngs of new followers and lucrative endorsement deals. By coming out against trans players, Cunningham became MAGA's favorite women's basketball player. Don't blame Cunningham, said Joe Nocera in the Free Press. The league could have avoided its trans mess just by following the lead of the Olympics or the Women's Tennis Association, whose rule books now clarify that woman means biological woman. because that would anger its progressive and LGBTQ plus fan base. However, WNBA executives are responding to the firestorm with meek, meaningless calls for inclusivity. Their cowardice also explains why the league's race issue isn't going away. When the Chicago Sky's Dejounte Carrington blamed white privilege last week after being ejected for a flagrant foul on Cunningham, the league stayed silent. Unless it can develop a spine, the WNBA will remain a pinata in the culture wars. The good news, said Helen Lewis in The Atlantic, is that all this drama is a byproduct of the league's astonishing success. Since Clark arrived, TV viewership has doubled, and TV revenues have quadrupled to $200 million. Player salaries have soared. Any emergent sports league has growing pains, said Will Leitch in The Washington Post. The WNBA can survive the culture wars so long as the quality of the product, the actual basketball, remains high. If you haven't seen a game lately, the player skills are better than ever, and the WNBA's product is magnificent. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for calling in sick. After Melania Trump failed to make a single public appearance with her husband or on her own for about a month, skipping Senator Lindsey Graham's funeral, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and the president's trip to a NATO summit in Turkey. It's a good week for domestic tuba production. After the Commerce Department proposed a new 25% tariff on the import of brass musical instruments, including trumpets, tubas, and French horns, in the supposed interest of national security. And it was a good week for keeping it real. After Senator Darlene Graham, running to keep the Senate seat of her late brother, Senator Lindsey Graham, admitted in a televised debate she couldn't explain the importance of Taiwan to U.S. interest. "I'm not that informed on national security," Graham said. But it was a bad week for replicas. After Woodhenge, a wooden replica of Stonehenge built in 2015 outside a British pub, was destroyed in a fire. Pub owner Charlie Newman said that while the structure didn't match the 5,000-year-old lifespan of its ancient namesake, it was quite substantial and stood out on the horizon. It's a bad week for preheating. After South Korean farmers harvesting potatoes after a record-breaking heat wave of 100-degree temperatures found they had already cooked in the ground. "How can I even put it into words? I'm so upset," said Lee Sang-hyuk, who has farmed his land for 40 years. Finally, it was a bad week for social contagion. After mixed martial arts icon Conor McGregor announced that he's returning to drinking after years of sobriety, saying he was inspired by Brad Pitt's revelation that he's cautiously resumed drinking wine. "Take it easy, Brad," wrote McGregor in a social media post while declaring his intention to have a few pints. And in other news, Trump seeks to strip national forest protections. The Trump administration this week moved to open almost 45 million acres of pristine national forest to logging and road construction. The U.S. Forest Service proposed repealing the roadless rule, a 2001 stricture that blocked most development and timber harvesting in certain national forests, largely in the West. Republicans argue the rule slows development, and President Trump says the firefighters need more roads to reach remote wildfires. He has also called for more logging in national forests, in part to counter lumber competition from Canada. Environmentalists decried the plan, saying it will destroy untouched landscapes and crucial wildlife habitats, including within Alaska's Tongass National Forest, the world's largest intact temperate rainforest. "Opening our backcountry forest to more roads and development is not a wildfire solution, and never will be," said Josh Hicks of the Wilderness Society. The briefing this week is titled, The Big Stall. America has fallen far behind China in the electric vehicle race. Can it catch up? How big is China's EV industry? China's automakers last year made nearly 16 million electric vehicles, a whopping 75% of all EVs sold globally. The U.S. produced only 5%. More than half of new cars sold in China are now EVs. Here it's about 10%. And those vehicles are in heavy demand around the world. Tariffs of up to 127.5% have kept them out of the U.S., but 80% of EVs sold in Latin America are Chinese, as are 75% in Southeast Asia and 57% in Australia. It's a staggering turnaround for China, which in 2000 made only 2 million cars a year, all of them gas-powered. Today, China's EVs impress with their affordability. Budget models run as low as $7,800 compared to with $29,000 for a Chevrolet Bolt in the U.S. Reliability, battery range, and luxury features that come as standard, such as massage chairs, big screens, and built-in refrigerators. With every major nation except the U.S., shifting from gas to battery-powered cars, a move that's been accelerated by the Iran war driving up oil prices, China's dominance is expected to grow. We've reached a genuinely existential moment for U.S. automakers, said Stephen Ezel of the Washington-based Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. How did China become an EV power? It began in 2001 when Beijing realized EVs would help it solve multiple problems at the same time, said China-based auto analyst Bill Russo. Energy security, environmental pollution concerns, and industrial competitiveness. It pumped more than $230 billion into the EV sector over 15 years, funding new automakers and new battery and charging technologies. Beijing also offered EV buyers rebates and tax incentives, constructed the world's largest network of public charging stations, and helped automakers build vertically integrated supply chains. BYD, which overtook Tesla last year as the world's top EV producer, mines its own lithium, makes its own batteries and semiconductors, and even exports cars on its own ships. Recognizing the challenge, President Barack Obama in 2009 launched a $2.4 billion grant program to boost EV development in the U.S. A $465 million loan helped Tesla get its breakout Model S to market. Under President Joe Biden, the federal government put $7.5 billion toward charging networks and offered billions more in incentives for buyers and automakers. Many of those efforts were scrapped following President Trump's return to the White House last year. What did Trump do? Calling climate change a con job, Trump signed into law a GOP mega bill that nixed a $7,500 tax credit for new EV buyers. His administration had dismantled clean air regulations and fuel economy standards that spurred carmakers to move toward EVs. It has also challenged states' authorities to set their own tougher standards. You're not going to be forced to make all those cars, Trump said last year, while signing a law aimed at killing rules from California, which would phase out the sale of new gas-only cars by 2035. EV sales had already stalled in the U.S. before those actions, with potential buyers discouraged by high prices and concerns over range and charging access. But withdrawal of federal support caused the market to slump, with the new EV sales plunging 27% year-over-year in the first 3 months of 2026. How have U.S. automakers responded? Starting in December, the so-called Big Three, Ford, GM, and Stellantis, owner of Chrysler and Jeep, announced more than $52 billion in write-downs on EV-related losses and set about what GM called a strategic realignment. The companies canceled planned EV models, stop production of current ones, such as Ford's F-150 Lightning pickup, and repurpose their battery plants for other uses, including making batteries for data centers. The retreat has alarmed industry analysts who say U.S. automakers are dooming themselves to irrelevance by doubling down on gas guzzlers. What's at stake? The U.S. auto industry generates $1.2 trillion each year, nearly 5% of GDP, and directly employs some 7.4 million Americans. It indirectly supports millions more jobs. To safeguard the industry, Republican and Democratic lawmakers have rallied behind legislation that would ban companies with more than 15% Chinese ownership from selling cars in the U.S. We are not competing on a level playing field when China subsidizes its manufacturers and uses slave labor, said Representative Debbie Dingell, Democrat from Michigan. Some analysts call protectionism a losing cause. They suspect public demand for Chinese cars will ultimately prove too great, especially as they proliferate in Mexico and Canada, which in January began letting in up to 49,000 Chinese EVs annually. That same month, Trump expressed openness to letting Chinese firms make cars here, so long as they use American workers and inputs. Proponents say that approach would light a fire under U.S. carmakers and build their knowledge and capabilities while driving up consumer demand for EVs. Are U.S. carmakers ready for that? Not yet. Some are developing smaller, cheaper EVs they hope will challenge Beijing's offerings. Ford is rolling out a $30,000 midsize pickup EV next year. The Detroit giant is also trying to grow its EV skills by partnering with Chinese firm Geely on models for the European market, while attempting to strengthen its operations here at home. Ford is pitching the Trump administration on a plan that would let Chinese automakers into the U.S. only through joint ventures in which an American firm would hold the controlling stake. That setup would mirror the deals Beijing struck decades ago with Western automakers eager to enter the Chinese market. Ford CEO Jim Farley, who in 2024 said he's been driving a fantastic Xiaomi SU7 sedan for 6 months, believes U.S. firms have no choice but to learn from China. "You don't become fit like the rest of the Chinese," he said. "You aren't going to be around much longer." And we'll read a few of the best columns. First up is, why is Trump's health a state secret? "For much of the past year, President Trump has not looked well," said Jonathan Reiner. "I am a cardiologist who treated Vice President Dick Cheney's heart problems, which he candidly disclosed. I have not examined President Trump, but I have reviewed what his doctors have made public and what is visible to everyone. The purple bruises on both hands, the swelling of his legs, his struggles to stay awake at every Oval Office event. The 80-year-old Trump has been undergoing frequent, mysterious medical evaluations. 22 consultants were summoned for one, and at another, he had advanced imaging of his heart and abdomen. Why? Clearly, we've been kept in the dark too long. The president has unparalleled power, yet there is no formal requirement for the commander-in-chief to certify his fitness for duty. That's a mistake. The 25th Amendment does, however, permit Congress to establish an independent medical panel to assess the president's physical and mental health. We need such a panel on a permanent basis to review medical exams of the current and future presidents and ensure they're truthful. In a democracy, the people must have confidence in the health of their leader." College life breeds belief in socialism. Why do so many young college graduates embrace socialism? Asked Kimberly Josephson. The usual assumption is that professors are indoctrinating students, but college life itself may be the main factor. To attract students, today's university campuses offer lavish student centers, comfortable residence halls, well-equipped recreation facilities, dining halls with widely varied all-you-can-eat meals, and tutoring and writing centers. Students can enjoy these luxe amenities without ever reaching for a wallet. None of it is actually free, of course. It's paid for by tuition that now surpasses $90,000 a year at elite colleges or financial aid provided through wealthy alumni endowments. But for most students, the actual cost of these expensive goodies is invisible. This illusion shapes students' understanding of markets and their own economic expectations. When young people graduate, they often experience sticker shock at the cost of adult life, when everything they consume has to be paid for. No wonder they believe that government should provide public transportation, medical care, and child care for free, and strictly limit the cost of housing. It's a blinkered way of thinking, but in college, young people are shielded from how the real world works. This column comes from Russia. The Kremlin is running scared. The Kremlin thought it was being so clever, said Andrei Kolonikov. It was going to let Yabloko, the oldest liberal political party in Russia, and the only anti-war party, run in next month's parliamentary elections as a token opposition. The point was for Yabloko to lose overwhelmingly to the pro-Kremlin United Russia Party so President Vladimir Putin could demonstrate the weakness of the opposition to the Ukraine war. See how united the people are, Putin could say. But the Kremlin failed to foresee how much Russians crave an opposition. Many people who normally don't vote began showing their support by posting memes of apples. Yabloko means apple. Rejecting the ideological dope forced on them in school, young people felt a civic duty to back Yabloko, despite knowing United Russia would be declared the winner. Putin's government then panicked and had the Supreme Court disqualify Yabloko on a flimsy excuse. The Kremlin scheme became a manifestation not of strength, but of weakness. Russians could see that gas lines are long, that Ukrainian drones are exploding in their cities, that ordinary folks are being locked up for speaking the truth. The Russian people are starting to lose their fear, and soon Putin will be the one who is afraid. We'll do one more column from Romania. Urban myth meets online hoax. Fake news is having real-life consequences in Romania now that an online hoax can whip up a vigilante mob, said Radu Hosu. An urban legend about child snatchers cruising around Transylvania has circulated for decades. And last week, viral videos claimed the nightmare had come true and that there was an ambulance stealing children. So when villagers spotted paramedics taking a patient to the hospital in Cluj-Salaj, they attacked the vehicle with pitchforks, axes, and clubs. The driver was nearly blinded by flying glass. That these rumors have resulted in violence is hardly surprising. Even under communism, Romanians were a conspiratorial bunch, and now we are the EU country where functional illiteracy is the highest and trust in institutions is lowest. Plus, Russia has been seeding misinformation here as part of its hybrid war on Europe. The 2024 presidential election had to be annulled after a Russia media campaign boosted the far-right pro-Russia candidate, Kalin Grosescu, to victory. How long before a gang of Grosescu disciples beats up some poor soul some influencer has called a traitor? Instead of helping, President Nikusar Dan is fueling the flames, throwing more lies at the army of scoundrels, extremists, and Russians in Romania. Unless our leaders do something to reverse this trend of stupidity, we'll be at the mercy of the mobs. And the last word, our in-depth article, Inside America's Shoplifting Lab. Big retailers are turning to a Florida research center to study shoppers and prevent them from stealing, said Alexander Salmon in Slate. Customer satisfaction is not guaranteed. They call it Justin's General Store, and in theory, there is no place on earth harder to steal from. Every item sits beneath a chandelier of cameras. The clothes are tagged with sensors that screech or squirt ink. The baby formula sits on shelves that actively monitor weight fluctuations. The razor blades hang on kinked display hooks. And the Tide Pods are incarcerated behind various plexiglass cases under lock and key. It is the future of retail, and it's all in one place at the University of Florida. Nowhere is there a higher concentration of theft-thwarting tech and thief-busting research. Nobody in the world has this complete of capability, Dr. Reed Hayes told me. Hayes is the executive director of the Loss Prevention Research Council and the steward of America's leading lab to prevent shoplifting, located in muggy Gainesville, Florida. He is best known as the man who brought the scientific method to shoplifting studies. No ideology, just cold, hard facts and figures. The LPRC does it all and gathers the reports. It tests out the technology. It grills the criminals and it recommends the solutions. It even produces the data that says there's a problem in the first place. We were in the LPRC conference room where a U-shaped conference table faced a television screen. On it appeared the logos of seemingly every retail company in the country, Walmart and Amazon and IKEA and Dollar General and Kroger and Tractor Supply Company and Publix and Verizon, 190 in all. They are dues-paying members of LPRC, Hayes told me, and all of them pony up thousands of dollars a year. It's a bargain for them, he joked, given the depth of information he and his team provide. In the conference room, the Brain Trust meets. The vice president of Sam's Club and her team had just been in. The retailers bring their problems, their grainy footage, their upsetting tales. The solution partners convey their wares. Hayes and team ingest it all, and science commences. In-house loss prevention teams from various retailers can come and test out the technologies in a judgment and sales-free zone and decide how best to arm themselves to stop loss. Before we could talk numbers, we needed to talk coinages. I had to learn the language of stopping lifting. Many were Hayes' own inventions. First was the bow tie model. A bow tie sticker was placed handily at each comfortable table seat. The left side of the bow tie was blue, split into vertical quadrants, each section a lighter shade, left to right, as it approached the knot. The right side was red, tending darker through all four vertical stripes. Shoplifters, on the road to stealing, progress through a color-coded countdown to crime. Zone 5, he told me, the far left of the bow tie represents the parking lot, or even online. Zone 4 was in front of the store. Zone 3 was inside the store. Zone 2 was in the aisle. And Zone 1, that was crime time. The right side of the bow tie was the same stages in reverse, as the criminal takes the item from the shelf to aisle to store to the parking lot and home. Effect, detect, connect, read the bow tie sticker, which I was encouraged to keep. There was a rack of white lab coats, in sizes ranging from small to extra large. Hayes' father was a medical doctor. He himself holds a Ph.D. in criminology from the University of Leicester in England. There was no medical research going on in the LPRC, Hayes told me, and no medical doctors on staff. But the dues-paying visitors liked to wear the coats when they visited, just to get in the spirit of scientific research. We take photos with the lab coats on, Hayes says. The young energy wearing lab coats, they love it, he said of the retailers. From the moment I arrived at LPRC, it was clear that I would not be walking out with anything. I would not be boosting, lifting, swiping, nicking, pinching, jacking, pocketing, rack rating, or any of the like. Certainly I would not filch, would not pilfer, would not purloin. There would be no five-finger discount, and my fingers would not become sticky. I would not graze, and I most assuredly would not be engaged in organized retail crime, a pervasive and influential term, Hayes told me he came up with it, that explains a lot of what you see in your local drugstore these days. Shoplifting, a major issue. There wouldn't be so many words for it if there weren't a lot of people doing it. And in these United States, the American people are doing it a lot and more than ever, or so it is said. Shoplifting losses are up a staggering 93% since before COVID, according to one disputed report. American corporations lose $112 billion to shoplifting in 2022, according to another report that some would dispute. So bad is the problem that we don't even know how bad the problem is, in fact. Prosecutors, woke, hemmed in by criminal justice reform, won't prosecute it. The police, underfunded, understaffed, discouraged, are so powerless to stop it, they don't show up when the calls come in, which means retailers have just stopped calling. So there isn't a legal record of the extent of the issue, which is nevertheless worse than you can imagine. Politicians of both parties who agree on nothing else know this is so. One of the only bills to pass through the current, most bitterly divided House of Representatives is the Combating Organized Retail Crime Act, which House Democrats joined 203 Republicans to greenlight. It grants the Department of Homeland Security and ICE vast new powers to collect Americans' personal information to stop retail theft. This just happened in May. Not only are retailers losing money and goods, they are losing hearts and minds. In the annals of TikTok are countless videos of people shoplifting, doing flash robs and smash and grabs, and ripping off the returns department. Numerous people I spoke to about this article confessed readily to shoplifting, particularly from the self-checkout at Whole Foods. There is no shame. The social contract has been abrogated, such people argue. According to research from the St. Louis Fed, retail trade has accounted for more corporate profit inflation post-COVID than any other sector. Still, prices keep going up, and the billionaire class lives above the law and regulation and yearns for the trillionaire class. The American citizen was once happy to be a paying customer, but no more. But you don't need hearts and minds when you have the vanguard technologies of social control and surveillance to fight the epidemic of shrink. Enter the LPRC. They're the only organization I know of doing actual scientific research. I'm not aware of anyone else doing that, said Stephanie Hoover, editor-in-chief of Loss Prevention Magazine. But on the matter of verifiable data, not everyone I spoke to was so impressed. I would be very skeptical of the LPRC's statistics and studies. Most, if not all of them, are funded by the big shrink reduction companies, said Rachel Steyer, author of The Steal, A Cultural History of Shoplifting. And it's in those companies' interest to exaggerate the problem of shoplifting. Really, the only gold standard study on shoplifting came out of Columbia University in 2008. It found that about 10% of Americans have a history of shoplifting, and that those people are also significantly more likely to engage in other illegal money-making activities like scamming and gambling. This was before those things were legalized. Since then, the research has come from industry groups. Did it matter if the data wasn't perfectly solid? The industry was ascendant, the lobbyists were in motion, and the politicians were amenable. According to loss and safety intelligence platform ThinkLP, retail loss detection is not just about preventing theft anymore. It's a sophisticated market projected to reach $43 billion by 2031, per Business Research Insights. When I entered the first chamber of LPRC's famed shoplifting lab, it turned out to be made to look like a parking lot, with printouts on the wall. There was a cardboard cutout of a nearly full-size male security officer. We were in Zone 5. A tree of surveillance cameras was perched on one side. With an introduction of AI, this particular installation, atop a lamppost, would unlock all sorts of shoplifting prevention. As the cameras monitored the lot, they would be able to detect loiterers, ne'er-do-wells, and the like. Spending too long in Zone 5 could be an indication that one was on the path to crime. And an AI-generated voice would call down to the would-be boosters with specificity, meant to strike fear with a human touch. "The red sedan, please leave," for example, said Josh Bush, research project coordinator. "It can give the impression of active monitoring." From there, we passed into some of the staged aisles of Justin's general store, where various high theft items were displayed on fake shelves. Cereal, baby formula. I looked at a shaving kit locked inside a plastic box, which was referred to as a freedom case. There were various kinked hooks and plastic buffers and knobs, plexiglass, shields that had to be slid one way or another, all inconveniences that caused shoppers friction, which happened to be good at stopping crime. The problem, of course, is that they are also good at stopping sales altogether. Sometimes you cure the disease and lose the patient. Bush pointed to a pile of plaster in our aisle. "We're never getting our security deposit back on ceiling tiles," he joked. That was because they had affixed so many ceiling-mounted surveillance cameras to drop ceiling of the lab that the panels were routinely buckled beneath the weight and came crashing to the ground. I marveled at the number of obsidian half-domes mounted overhead. Some of these, AI-enabled, would even quote you how much potential revenue a customer was worth walking through the door. Next to each item in Justin's, there was a QR code, a manufacturer logo, and a brand name. It was a rare opportunity for retailers to browse the many loss prevention options, all the brands in the same place, without a pesky sales associate peering over their shoulder. Some of the tools had cool names. The alarming Rhino Wrap, for instance, made by ISS, was protecting the laundry detergent. We progressed from household items, through toys, through top-shelf booze. Grey Goose is a top target and could be contained with lid caps. And on clothing. Everyone knows that shoplifters love clothing because they are often teenage girls. The clothing section featured a combination of the analog and the digital. Wired changing rooms that didn't record video but tracked chips upon entry. Dye tags large and small. Some of the stuff was familiar but smaller. RFID chips, an invention on par with the barcode in terms of impact on retail that rolled out widely in the early 2000s, could now be as small as a speck of glitter. But their uptake for loss prevention purposes has been slow. There were explanations for this. It was expensive and required manufacturers, which were scattered all across the globe, to buy in. Still in the general store, there were little RFID stickers affixed to items like perfume and clothes, next to the Shrink Buster Mini, for instance, or the pinless pin tag. Finally, we arrived in the grocery department. Here was the holy grail of corporate loss prevention failure. I slid by a retail employee mannequin bedecked in body cameras. Loss prevention strategists are enthusiastic about this approach, which has already launched, and approached the self-checkout machine. Self-checkout was supposed to be a bottom-line boom. Out with the labor, in with the machine. Customers seemed to like it, but then it became clear that at least part of what they liked was stealing from it. Some companies have since scrapped it altogether. But here was an integrated, top-of-the-line system with sliding doors that would open only after a receipt was scanned, confirming one's purchases. There were video cameras high and low, watching us, watching our hands, making sure that there was no funny business. With Bush's help, we set out to scan two items, put them in the bagging area, and exit. The peanut butter rang up and was placed in the bagging area. The instant coffee sailed across the scanner and did not ding. An eyebrow arched. The item was placed in the bagging area, and still no alarms were triggered. We took the items, took the receipt, and proceeded to the double doors. We scanned the receipt, the door swung open, and we were on the bad side of the bow tie. 4, 3, 2, 1, and we could see the exit to Justin's, out into the hallway, and we would be free. The receipt reader would need some adjusting. Live by the demo, die by the demo, said Bush. This was abridged from a story originally published in Slate. On the health and science page, we have why you should smile at your dog. Flashing your dog a smile will make it nearly as happy as if you give it a treat, a new research shows. Researchers at the University of Vienna trained pet dogs to lie still and awake inside an MRI scanner, then showed them photos of unfamiliar people wearing one of four expressions: happiness, sadness, fear, or anger. Happy faces lit up the regions of the pup's brains tied to visual, social, and reward processing, a sign that the animals registered something pleasant and are getting, effectively, a little dopamine hit. The brain scans suggest that dogs can not only tell a joyful human face from a miserable one, but also distinguish among flavors of unhappiness. Earlier work had shown that dogs could tell a positive expression from a negative one, but it was unclear whether the animals grasped subtler emotional shades. In this research, activity across the whole brain demonstrates that dogs have different reactions to expressions of fear, sadness, and anger. But the biggest reaction of all comes in response to a happy face. The researchers say their findings indicate that years of living alongside humans has actually changed dogs' brain circuitry, linking cheerful human faces to motivation and pleasure. We can reward our dogs with treats, but also reward them with happiness, neuroscientist Laura Quaya, co-author of the study, tells BBC.com. So we should smile at the dogs, even at random dogs in the street. Does inflammation harm the heart? The failure in clinical trials of a much-hyped new heart drug cast doubt on the theory that inflammation drives the buildup of artery-clogging plaque, reports European Biotechnology. Novo Nordisk stunned the field when it revealed that ziltivekimab, which had been thought to be a potential blockbuster, proved no more effective than a placebo. The drug does tamp down inflammation, but it doesn't seem to save lives. In the study of more than 6,300 patients with heart or advanced kidney disease, all showing elevated markers of inflammation in their blood, those who took ziltivekimab saw those markers plunge, yet their rates of cardiovascular complications and death didn't budge. That raises the question, is inflammation actually a cause of heart disease or merely a symptom that rides alongside it, in the way gray hair accompanies aging? Some researchers argue that the trial's patients may simply have been too sick to benefit, and that decades of other evidence from pathology, animal work, and epidemiology shows support for the inflammation theory. But others now suspect that treating inflammation may not help once plaque has taken hold. Sanjay Kaul, a cardiologist at Cedars-Sinai Hospital, quoted Thomas Huxley, "The great tragedy of science, the slaying of a beautiful hypothesis, is an ugly act. On the Talking Points page, Leavitt, why she's irreplaceable. Caroline Leavitt has served President Trump well, said David Gardner in the Daily Beast. Unfortunately for the rest of us, the 29-year-old White House press secretary, who last week announced she was stepping down to look after her two young children, did so by defending him with all the wide-eyed devotion of a member of a religious cult. During her 20-month tenure, the worst press secretary in modern times routinely attacked reporters as biased lefty hacks, hotly defended Trump's sharing of a social media video that portrayed the Obamas as apes, claimed the Democratic Party's constituency was Hamas terrorists, illegal aliens, and violent criminals, and called Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking ring a hoax. One of Trump's most fiercely loyal aides, she drank the Kool-Aid, the whole bottle. Trump wanted to keep her, but he might have inadvertently driven her out, said Margaret Hartman in New York. During her recent 9-week maternity leave, Trump reportedly kept pestering about when she was coming back, making it clear to the burned-out Leavitt that she had to choose between her family and the very needy president. Leavitt leaves behind a press operation reimagined for the MAGA media landscape, said Kara Vogt and Meredith McGraw in the Wall Street Journal. During her tenure, the White House booted many mainstream journalists out of the press pool so it could seat it with pro-Trump podcasters and influencers. Leavitt knew she could count on softballs from Trump sycophants, said Bill Gutekunst in the Arizona Republic, such as a question from a representative of MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell's streaming channel about how Trump managed to look healthier than ever before. She even ousted the Associated Press for refusing to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. Leavitt's predecessors were all spin doctors, but no one before had used the position not just to defend their boss, but to deny what he said even when it was on video. Why even try to fill the job after Leavitt's reign of error, said Rex Hupke in USA Today. No one can replace this smiling, fake flunky who wore incongruous crucifixes while dutifully spewing half-baked lies and insults. Trump can save taxpayers $200,000 by eliminating the press secretary job and doing his own propaganda. Cut out the distributor and serve me my fascism fresh. Thank you very much. Democrats backing away from woke one. For years, Democrats have debated whether the progressive politics that surged around 2020 went too far, said Pilar Melendez and Alan Smith in NBCNews.com. Now Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, borrowing a phrase from New York Councilman Shea Aussey, has officially admitted it. Woke one, she said last week, was crazy. Wokeness has become a shorthand for a series of former progressive priorities, defunding the police, self-flagellating admissions of guilt about privilege, and the adoption of stilted academic terms like Latinx to prove your elevated consciousness. Those who failed these tests could be attacked on social media and canceled. Donald Trump returned to power amid a backlash against wokeness, said Astead Herndon and Vox, so Democrats are backing away from previous woke stances. In this election cycle, they hope to reintroduce themselves after workshopping their ideas over the last 5 years. Sorry, but the only lesson Democrats seem to have learned is that some politics are so toxic politically as to deny them office, said Kimberly A. Strassel in the Wall Street Journal. AOC and her cohort can chuckle about the extremist positions they held, but there's nothing funny about those whose lives were forever damaged by the woke one era. Just ask the Americans who lost jobs or friends, or who were otherwise canceled for violating far-left orthodoxy. Some dissenters were branded Nazis, fascists, or xenophobes for wanting a secure border. Woke Democratic prosecutors released violent criminals to commit new crimes. Is this the part where we laugh with AOC? I think we can all agree that there were some embarrassing excesses in the Woke One era, said Arwa Mandawi in The Guardian. But just take a minute and look around. Roe has been toppled, immigrants are being snatched off the street by mass thugs, and Trump is amassing billions in corrupt riches. Progressives shouldn't play into the Republican hands by apologizing for Woke One instead of focusing on the dire state of the country right now. Besides, Americans aren't angry at woke anymore, said Luke Winkie in Slate. Today, their fury is directed at masked ICE thugs, tech oligarchs, data centers, inflation, and incompetent public officials. Democrats have an opportunity to carve out a more practical, forward-looking wokeness, focusing on fairness, human rights, and empathy, without the guilt and pedantic scolding tone. A better world is still possible, so long as we're not too annoying about it. And we've just time for a quote to finish out the show. C.S. Lewis, quoted in The Economist, says, "A children's story which is enjoyed only by children is a bad children's story." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.